From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Comedian Patton Oswalt was an addict for 4 years in the mid-90s. He devoured movies in theaters around Los Angeles, seeing over 250 in 1 year, absorbing the greats, Sunset Boulevard, Belle de Jour, Dr. Strangelove, Cool Hand Luke, working to be a better stand-up comedian, dreaming of being a great director. He came out the other side, and now he's documented his love of film, his start in the Los Angeles comedy world, and much more in his new book, Silver Screen Fiend. This hour on Point, comedian, actor, and writer Patton Oswalt on his movie addiction and coming into the creative life. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you made that journey through obsession to the creative life? Can you picture being obsessed with movies? Is that you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from New York is Patton Oswalt, one of the best stand-up comedians around today. His new book is Silver Screen Fiend. For an excerpt, go to our website, onpointradio.org. You may know him as the voice of Remy in Pixar's beloved Ratatouille, or from his role in CBS's King of Queens sitcom. He's acted in many films, including Young Adult and Big Fan. He started the Comedians of Comedy stand-up tour. Patton Oswalt, welcome to On Point.
Tom, thanks for having me on.
I love this book.
I really appreciate it. Wow. Thank you.
I tell you, it just captures something. I mean, you've got Movie Mania on the cover and in the title with Silver Screen Fiend, but you're weaving another story through this, and maybe they're part of the same story about this coming into the creative life, and that really captured me. We'll come to that, but I love this one description you have of movies, and you write, I'm quoting you here, the defiant 24 frames per second mechanical heartbeat you're describing here of a 35 millimeter film projector whispering that the world's time doesn't apply to you. What was this time in the 1990s when you were so prepared to almost lose yourself in that world, Patton?
I think I was ready to lose myself the way that you say, because I didn't know who I was yet. So it was much easier for me to give myself over to a pursuit. I'd kind of given myself over to becoming a comedian full time. That's all I wanted to do. And then I discovered all these rep movie houses, which I really didn't have access to, you know, growing up on the East Coast, a place where they would project old movies and you would experience them with an audience. And the classics, you know, really can hit you way harder than a lot of the newer stuff that is supposedly made just for you. Now I'm looking at stuff that not only did it cut across time, I'm watching something from 1941, but it's totally grabbing me. Mm-hmm. But in the time that it takes the film to unspool, that is a chunk of time that's just mine, that however long the film takes, that fills up those 2 hours and I'm not on the world's time for that moment. It's a very powerful, autonomous feeling for somebody that did not feel very powerful or autonomous a lot in his life at that point.
There's something pretty fantastic about it, and yet I'm so curious in that progress toward the creative life, because you were in it already. You had established yourself, or were establishing yourself, in the comedy world, and yet this siren song of the movie. You start the book with talking about Sunset Boulevard, Gloria Swanson. Here's a little clip with her as Norma Desmond. 1950s, big film, Sunset Boulevard.
There's nothing else, just us and the cameras and those wonderful people out there in the dark. All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
Boy, it reaches right out to me, right over the air, right here, even without the visual.
You know, and the visual is amazing. She stands up and puts her hand up into the light of the projector like she's trying to grab a tiny chunk of her past and make it happen. I mean, what she just described is what I was just saying. What she's saying is the effect that movies have on the viewers have the same effect on the people that are making them while they make them.
And here you were in this kind of catalytic state. It wasn't the first time that you'd come to that. You describe in the book how your first obsession was with comedy, And yes. You would listen to comedic albums over and over again until you had them down. You got a little reading here about how when you were younger, and comedy was the obsession, whether it was Bill Cosby or Steve Martin or you name it. Could you read a bit from that, Patton,
sure.
about just how tightly, so we get a sense of your mind and how it works when it gets obsessed.
Yeah. Well, when you hear this section, you'll see how my mind was so ready to get rewired by movies and get obsessed this little section here. I knew the exact timing for the pause between the words waited and July in Bill Cosby's revenge routine. Not only did I memorize every heckler put down on Rodney Dangerfield's No Respect and Steve Martin's A Wild and Crazy Guy, I could even recite perfectly the hecklers walking themselves into vinyl, drunken, douchebag immortality. Yes, I could recite George Carlin's Seven Dirty Words and all their permutations, Richard Pryor's multi-character God Was a Junkie off of Super Nigger, and pretty much every single flawless word from Emo Phillips' E equals M-O squared and Stephen Wright's I Have a Pony. I could also sing every Python song and recite word perfect the bookshop sketch off of Monty Python's Contractual Obligation album. Come senior year, I did bookshop in a forensic competition. Both voices back and forth. That was the first time I experienced, if only secondhand, the effect that doing comedy had on the comedian. The laugh you get after dropping your joke is akin to a rush of emotional heroin after the nerve-scraping silence of the setup. That's how the addiction begins. But unlike a common junkie, you crave the discomfort as much as you do the high. The risk of that silence sputtering into nothing, or worse, anger and jeering from an audience, is what makes the laughter that much sweeter. And you keep chasing that scenario where you artificially set up the deadly, deafening, jarring silence, and then the gentle roaring through your veins surf crash of laughter.
Of laughter. Patton Oswalt reading Boom. From Silver Screen Fiend from those years when he was 19 and he had listened to every comedy album out there on his parents' turntable in the 1990s. What, you were in your late 20s, early 30s, that
yeah.
same I turned to movies.
Yeah, I started stand-up when I was 19. And then suddenly I'm in Los Angeles. I moved there in 95. Mm-hmm. So I'm still in my late 20s at that point. I'm so bad at math. Please, listeners, do the math.
We'll forgive you the math. You've got bigger calculations here.
Yeah. But I had already absorbed the one obsession and it made me leap into doing it. In other words, I was obsessed with comedy. Now I'm suddenly doing it. Now but suddenly I see a much broader, bigger world, which is movies. You know, because making the leap mm-hmm. from comedy is I'm just making the leap by myself. To make the leap into movies, I would have to convince 20, 30 people to get obsessed with the same thing I'm obsessed with making and keep that obsession sustained through the filming process. That just seemed impossible to me.
The money people, the cameramen, the actors, everybody, the producers,
yes.
all of it.
And it was clear just from going to the New Beverly that it had been done over and over and over again by people. So that fascinated me.
The New Beverly cinema, right?
It was your go-to. The New Beverly cinema is this amazing rep theater in Los Angeles on Beverly Boulevard that this man Sherman Torgan ran for $5 every night. You got a double feature of classic movies or you know, maybe stuff from the 70s, 80s, early 90s indie stuff, a lot of 40s and 50s stuff. So I would just go there and absorb.
Describe just how obsessed you were for us, Patton.
It got so bad. I think my bottoming out point was when I was in an all-night horror movie marathon at the Cinerama Dome. So this was a 8 p.m. until 8 a.m., dawn to dusk, death march of classic horror movies. And a movie called Daughter of Horror, it's also been released as Dementia, had just ended. That's a movie that begins in outer space and Ed McMahon's disembodied head comes floating towards the camera and starts yelling at you for not understanding what nightmare and horror is. It's an amazing experience. And I was with my then girlfriend and she was like, I'm tired. It's 2 a.m. I want to go home. And the next movie was starting, I Married a Monster from Outer Space. And I was at that obsessive point where if I don't see the beginning of a movie, then it doesn't quote unquote count.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, I need to walk back to my car. With that, you're going to walk me back. And I was like, yeah, but if I miss the beginning of this And I made her walk back.
Alone at 3 a.m.
3 a.m. That is my, if I may quote Jerry Stahl, that is my leaving my baby in the car while I go get a fix a heroin moment when it's like, okay, now you've slipped out of your own humanity at this point.
But it was all in your mind in the interest of pushing through to a new, you were modeling. You were going to be that great. If you just watched enough, you'd be there.
I obsessed about comedy for 19 years, and then I became a comedian. Well, I'll do the same thing with films. But I kept forgetting the leap part. In terms of movies, I got way more drawn in to the obsession, I'm going to quote an amazing comic book writer named Matt Fraction. All I was doing was downloading. I wasn't doing any uploading. I wasn't putting anything back out into the world.
Were you in the company of others with this? I mean, it was maybe a little more difficult in those days. There weren't DVDs and easy stuff online. You had to do this, especially with us. You had to go to a theater. Did you feel in the company of other obsessives?
I mean, there were certain people that would go to theaters with me. But after a while, I mean, it just no one could keep pace with me. And they all fell away. And good for them. You know, they were I can't go to movies every single night with you, dude. So, it became a very singular kind of lone wolf thing to do, which I ended up kind of liking because there were times after a real, especially good movie, I might not have been in the mood to sit and start gabbing about it. I wanted to sit and absorb, you know.
Because you were the next great director.
I was the next great director.
Ready to be born. Patton Oswalt's new book is Silver Screen Fiend. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with comedian, writer, actor Patton Oswalt about his one-time, long-time movie addiction and coming into the creative life. His new book is Silver Screen Fiend. He calls it an addiction memoir. Joins us from New York. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. You may know him from King of Queens. You may know him from Big Fan or Young Adult, other films he's been in. He wrote an earlier memoir, Zombie Spaceship Wasteland, pretty terrific, in 2011. He was also the voice of Remy, lead rat in Ratatouille.
I brought you something to... No! Spit that out right now! I have got to teach you about food. Close your eyes. Now, take a bite of this. No! Don't just hork it down!
Too late.
Patton Oswalt, Remy, and Ratatouille. Of course, he made his name in stand-up here off of his 2007 album of stand-up, Werewolves and Lollipops, talking about writing movies.
I'm trying to write movies. It's hard, man. And it got even harder this year because they released a movie on DVD. It was made in 1977. They never released it. It just now got put out on DVD this year, and it's called Deathbed, The Bed That Eats People. I'm not making... Go IMDb this. This is a real movie. Deathbed, The Bed That Eats People.
He wanted into that world. It wasn't all Deathbed, The Bed That Eats People. There are real classics out there. He was practically lost in them in the late 1990s. 1942, here's Casablanca, that final scene with Humphrey Bogart as Rick.
Hilda, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. No. He's looking at you, kid.
Favorite of mine. Watch it enough and you'll be a great director, maybe... Maybe not. John in Austin, Texas is calling for you, Patton. John, you're on the air with Patton Oswalt.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Patton.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing, John?
I'm a great fan of the great film director Luis Buñuel.
Yes.
Who was a trained hypnotist. And
I didn't know that.
He insisted in his autobiography that movies were a form of hypnosis. The audience sits in the dark and surrenders its critical intelligence to the filmmaker, and who takes over the mind of the members of the audience.
I love it.
And he certainly was capable of doing that for over 50 years. And I wonder what you think about that analogy, and if you feel comfortable, if you do see there's some validity to it, Do you feel comfortable in letting just any film school grad, 28 years old, who knows how to do CGI, getting into your mind?
In the late 90s, he did. You were promiscuous, Patton, but what about it?
Well, you know, that's a good question, but here's the good news. Buñuel was a great hypnotist in that he was a great filmmaker, so you were in you're never in the hands of an incompetent, because incompetent filmmakers make the kind of stuff that you can always keep yourself once removed from and go, oh God, what is going on here? It's so the movies that take you over, the reason that they took you over is because it was made by an amazingly competent filmmaker and you can trust yourself in their hands.
Wait a minute. What about the evil genius? Does that not exist out there as well? A hypnotist filmmaker I don't know.
I mean, I don't know. Some could argue that people like Gaspar Noé are a bit of an evil genius, that where they're manipulating and messing with people. But I mean, to invest that much time and money and energy and other people's time in what would essentially end up being a prank, I don't know. I mean, did Leni Riefenstahl's movies ultimately, all they did was celebrate something. I don't think they really influenced anybody.
Ooh.
Do you know what I mean? That's
a good one to lay out on the table and say debate, right? I mean, after
well,
all.
Well, no, I'm just saying like Nazi, triumph
chief
of the will.
Nazi propagandist is not as if there weren't boots marching.
Yeah, except that those movies, they are very good spectacle, but they're not very human. You don't get pulled. You're kind of looking at the spectacle once removed, but you don't see it as a human, on a human level that pulls you in and makes you maybe go, oh, these guys have a point. You're just like, oh, wow, they're all.
Well, now, in 1939, Patton, I'm not sure.
I mean, other people outside of Germany, didn't they see Triumph of the Will? And it clearly didn't make Americans go, hey, I'm on board.
No, it didn't. I guess you had to be there. George Lucas, of course, with his Star Troopers, took a little something away from it.
But he did it to illustrate, you know, someone being evil.
Yeah, exactly. I love the question, though, and the notion of Buñuel as hypnotist. You certainly seemed hypnotized in the years you describe in Silver Screen Fiend. Andy in Concord, Massachusetts. You're on with Patton Oswalt.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Patton.
Hi.
And I'm a big fan. And first, let me say I will buy your book.
Thank you.
I can identify with your obsession. And it's your appreciation and love for geekdom, comic book, science fiction, film that you bring into comedy that I really love. So Guardians of the Galaxy, everyone says, that's James Gunn's love letter to geeks. Your bit on George Lucas and a time machine and Star Wars was cathartic. It was psychotherapy for so many fans out there. It's just
genius. Thank you.
Comedy.
High praise.
Thank you.
Thanks, Andy.
Yeah.
What do you say,
Thank
Patton?
You so much. I agree. I mean, look, I don't know what to say. It was really nice of him to say. I'm sorry.
Just take it. Just enjoy it. It's very true.
I'm going to take it.
Can we go to Van Gogh for a second? Andy took us to geekdom. Maybe Van Gogh was a kind of geek in his own way. But I love this notion that you have in Silver Screen Fiend. Here you were, on the one hand, you'd been obsessed with comedy clubs. You were very much in the comedy clubs, and we'll come to that. You were growing and acting and taking the stage, but you've had a succession in your life of what you call night cafes, and you sort of take off on Van Gogh's famous painting of the night cafe with those garish colors and kind of distended, distorted perspectives, just wonderful. The night cafe has a place in your coming into the creative life, and not just once, but again and again. What is this womb of the night cafe that you think and write about?
Well, it's this concept of the room that you enter, and when you come out of it, you're forever changed, either by what you experience in the room or what you see. So for me, you know, it was because when he made that painting, it was the first time he painted something from memory.
Gauguin had said, try painting from memory, Vincent.
Try painting from memory. And he did. And it opened up this whole other creative aspect for him because he went into a room in his mind that he hadn't really gone into yet. So I applied that to seeing, you know, Nosferatu when I was 5 in a little library, and oh my God, I want to be on the other side of that screen. I'm so terrified, but what is that? Going to do my first stand-up open mic, then going into the Holy City Zoo for the first time, going to the New Beverly for the first time, the Largo. It's just, it's the, and everyone has a version of this in their lives when it's a room that they go into and for everything is different.
It's kind of a conceptual room, maybe a real room.
Yeah, it could be conceptual. I mean, you must have had that in your life, Tom. Like if you're, when you got into radio, there must have been the first time that you broadcast, whatever that room was that you broadcast out of,
oh,
that's a night cafe for you.
Oh, yeah. And did it stretch my mind? And it was right after 9/11. I got thrown in cold into the bathwater, and it was totally mind-bending and completely addictive.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, so after that point, you're like, okay, well, now everything that I valued and thought was here's my routine, it's all been exploded.
Yeah, because there's something that's so overwhelming, and the catnip of that new way of seeing things so strong. If it works, you may be off and running. It was on Patton's mind when he sat in all those films, 250 in 1 year during the stretch of years he describes in Silver Screen Fiend. Let's go to Miami, Florida, Patton. Catherine, you're on the air with Patton Oswalt. Thanks for calling, Catherine.
Hi, yes. I had a comment about your laughing at yourself over the idea that by being obsessed with film, you could mm-hmm. become a great director. But that's exactly what happened with Bogdanovich. His obsession with Ford culminated in Last Picture Show. So it's still possible.
Peter Bogdanovich studies Last Picture Show, John Ford, or studies John Ford and comes out with Last Picture Show. The formula may work, Catherine.
Well,
yes, it could work.
All great directors were obsessed. I mean, most were obsessed with films. They would gobble up movies, and you know, people like Scorsese, especially Tarantino, and stuff like that. But what I did was, all I did was, I kind of stopped at the gobbling phase, and that's where I just kind of, you know, that's just sort of what I did. I didn't move beyond it. So I gotta do the next step and move beyond it.
In terms of making your own films, but you describe, and here's where it gets really interesting, and we go from, what, chess to 3D chess. During this time in the late 90s that you were obsessing on film, you were also in the comedy clubs. Alternative comedy was just coming into its own. There was a great club called The Largo, where you and many others were really feeling your oats. If one of your rooms of that time was the night cafe of the darkened cinema where you were watching film after film, and the other was the Largo, I hope you'll describe it for us, this comedy club,
yeah.
How were they cross-pollinating, Patton? Were they?
Well, they were. I mean, the Largo wasn't even a comedy club. It was a music club on Fairfax, and the owner, this guy Mark Flanagan, decided to have comedy in there one night a week on Monday nights, and it just became this great... It was the perfect setting for the kind of alt comedy that was exploding at the time, because the audiences were they were more used to the rhythms of music, and we were kind of following different rhythms as far as comedy and how to deliver it. It wasn't all just set up punchline.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the meeting of the perfect performers in front of the perfect audience to go together. And as far as, I mean, cross pollinating, at least for me. Was the fact that I was seeing how, especially when I was watching old movies like a lot of the Preston Sturges stuff and a lot of the Ernst Lubitsch and early W.C. Fields, the idea of going too far had already been done many, many times in the past in a lot of these movies. So it gave me the freedom to try going further and further with my own stuff.
There's a little bit from Dr. Strangelove you describe as inspiring you maybe in that direction. Here's just a little scene, classic Stanley Kubrick's, in the scene where General Turgidson, played by George C. Scott, and President Merkin Muffley, played by Peter Sellers, go at it. Get zany. You'll hear President Muffley first. We're talking nuclear weapons.
You're talking about mass murder, General, not war.
Mr. President, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed. But I do say no more than 10 to 20 million killed, tops, depending on the breaks.
I could easily see how alt comedy could take something from that, oh my gosh, over the topness and move it right to the Largo.
Yeah, the fact that they can, that they're making jokes about mega deaths. They're literally making jokes about mega deaths. So it's that idea of, once you tell a comedian you cannot, there is nothing funny about this subject, there is no way to joke about it, we're going to find a way to make a joke out of it. You know, especially when non-comedians tell comedians, let me tell you what you can and can't make jokes about. Yeah. Like, oh, I definitely want to hear this. Because whatever you tell me not to make a joke about, that's what I'm going to make a joke about.
And describe what was going on at the Largo in those nights. What was the terrain that was being broken open and celebrated?
It was a couple of things. It was a combination of people just talking about mundane life, everyday stuff that had just happened to them, and tying it into something much bigger and funnier and more cosmic, talking about, you know, subjects that people had, you know, trouble making jokes about in regular comedy clubs, you know, AIDS, cancer, rape, genocide, racism, stuff like that. But especially it was a kind of comedy where it was always from the viewpoint of the outsider, and it was always trying to punch upwards or take the maybe not the weirder view, but the okay, whatever anyone assumes is good or bad about this thing, I'm going to look at it a different way.
I love the way you describe. There's a kind of collegial piece to this, where a group of like-minded people, and that was your like-mindedness right there, get into something, and kind of through an effort of will and circumstance, break open new terrain. You describe in Silver Screen Fiend, you say, I remember watching Psych Out and The Trip and Head at the New Beverly Cinema, mm-hmm. seeing Jack Nicholson and Dennis Hopper getting to act in movies only because they also wrote and produced them.
Right.
Me and my friends got to go on stage only because we asked a bookstore or coffee shop manager to let us do a show. Then Easy Rider came along and pulled Nicholson and Hopper and, if they were close enough to their jet wash, everyone else in their crew into the establishment. And then came The Largo. What happened at The Largo?
Well, The Largo was the same thing, which is the everything that we had been doing because we were struggling, asking a bookstore owner to let us go up, asking a laundromat to let us do a show there. Now suddenly there's not only is there a regular room that's really, really well attended, but now there's people from the industry that we had always kind of been outsiders in, suddenly coming to watch us and give us opportunities, putting us in movies, putting us in TV shows. So, you know, it is that – I remember I just watched this amazing documentary called Blank City about the early 80s New York, people like Jim Jarmusch and Lydia Lunch coming up and making movies. And they suddenly Jean-Paul Basquiat?
Mm.
Basquiat or –
On which
Jean,
front?
That's the name.
Okay.
He suddenly became a millionaire overnight. Suddenly changed everything. Now one of us has a limo driver and a condo, and now what? So that was
it can
that
happen.
That can happen, and it kind of skews everyone else. Everyone else starts to go, oh, wait, what about me? Like it adds – suddenly success and ambition – added to the avant-garde and the outsiders really makes things interesting.
You're right. And then The Largo, where miraculously these two ideas, art and commerce, risk and opportunity, fused and created a nameless new drug. It hung in the air, a narcotic vapor, and we all breathed it. It made all of us ambitious, competitive, resentful, jealous, and ultimately more creative than we'd ever been before or since. At least that's how it affected me. At the birth, in a way, there of the L.A. alternative comedy scene, and in Patton Oswalt's case, all that being double-fueled by a movie obsession at the same time. Did you share that, or was this your secret on-the-side cinema narcotic, Patton?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, I wasn't secret about it. I was I was obnoxious, yeah. People were avoiding me because I would just rattle on about movies and yammer and it just be I was just unbearable. I was unbearable. So yeah, it would have been nice if I should have kept it a secret thing, but unfortunately, no. I never. It's like people that say that, you know, when you go gluten free, that you never shut up about it.
Shut
it's the
up
same
already.
Thing.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with comedian, writer, actor Patton Oswalt about his one-time, long-time movie addiction, he calls it, and coming into the creative life. His addiction memoir, his new book is Silver Screen Fiend. There's an excerpt you can read at our website, onpointradio.org. Patton Oswalt joins us from New York for several years in the 1990s. It was all film almost all the time for him at the little movie houses there, the New Beverly Cinema and others, where you could watch all night, and he did. The other part of his life was in the Largo and beyond, doing stand-up, doing kind of pioneering work in alternative comedy. Of course, he went on into movies and television. Here's a little bit of Patton Oswalt in King of Queens. His character Spencer, this was the CBS sitcom, frequently made fun of for being a nerd. He's being talking here with Deacon Palmer, played by Victor Williams. We'll hear Spencer first.
You never read the trilogy of Grun? It's a classic. It's been translated into like 50 different languages.
And he was doing so well. His girlfriend started dressing better, and now this.
This movie's going to be huge, and I'm going to be at the first show if I have to camp out for a week.
Have you ever actually met this girlfriend?
Skepticism right there. Of course, his stand-up comedy career has gone on as well. This is his album out last year, Tragedy Plus Comedy Equals Time. Patton Oswalt.
My fitness goals... one, I would like to stop looking like I'm wearing a bulletproof vest all the time. That'd be nice. That'd be a nice little change, not to have the bulletproof vest. Yeah. And then, also, I would like to not be in a rascal scooter at my daughter's high school graduation. That's my other. I don't want to be cut. I don't want to be muscular. I don't want to be trim. I want to be standing on my original kneecaps.
From Patton Oswalt's Tragedy Plus Comedy Equals Time. I love it. Harry in Burlington, Vermont, you're on the air with Patton Oswalt.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Patton, I'm a big fan. Two actually quick little questions. I'm a cartoonist. I do cartoons for the New Yorker. But, so I'm always looking for jokes and gags. And so there's two pieces here. The first is I was in Lululemon the other day, and there's a sign in Lululemon. I'm there with my wife.
This is the Tony Yoga.
Yeah, wait a minute. Were you shopping, or were you with your wife while she was shopping?
I was in there with my wife.
Nice save. Nice save, dude.
Lock letters, right? And in the store, it says, breathe. And I look at the sign, and I just study it for a second, and then I kind of break apart the letters, and I spell out, beat her.
Oh, Lord. In a yoga store?
So that's the first part, and my wife made me take it down from my Facebook page. Other part of the question is can you talk a little bit
about...
Hey, dude,
you know what? I'll see you in Salon Magazine. That's the latest outrage.
And we wondered where New Yorker cartoons came from, Lululemon.
Exactly.
And, okay, Harry, where are you going?
It's too irreverent. The other part is you did a piece that a friend of mine, who's a huge comic art collector, we both spend all of our children's tuition on comic book art, original art. Mm-hmm. He sent me a clip that you did of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, where it was a spinoff of kind of Apocalypse Now. It was all the Rankin-Bass thing, all stop-motion animation. Can you talk a little bit about how that came to be? Because I think it's just hilarious.
Yeah, there's a little a footnote about it in the book. When I was at Mad TV, two of the other writers, Spencer Green and Mary why am I blanking on her last name? They wrote a Rankin-Bass parody called The Rainfather, and it was like The Godfather, but done it with that thing. So then I pitched a follow-up called Pack of Gifts Now, which it's Santa Claus is going crazy at the North Pole, and he's just making these misfit toys, and so they send Rudolph up there to kill him, to terminate with it. It's Apocalypse Now. Okay. And, I wrote the original one, and then other people, added to it, obviously, and then this guy, Corky Quackenbush, animated it. And then they didn't do it when I was there, and then I left. I didn't leave. They didn't ask me back because I was such a douche.
Jerk.
Sorry to use that word, but that's what I was. And then they did it, and it got a lot of really positive attention. So I guess I felt kind of vindicated, but I should have been a better person because I could have actually been there when it got made. But there you go.
Harry, you're taking inspiration from that takeoff?
I was happy to see it, and that it must be a certain amount of gratification comes from seeing something that you come to see it. Have it come to life. So I was just happy.
It was nice. I was happy. Yeah.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer meets Apocalypse Now. Harry, it's good to hear from you. Thank you for calling. John in Buffalo, New York. John, you're on.
Hi. Thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Yes.
And I had a question for Patton.
Mm-hmm.
And,
yeah.
have you ever gotten to where you got critical of movies from watching them so much, as if, you know, you see like a movie error if someone's holding an object in one scene and the next scene is completely gone, and, you know, you just frustrate you, or you get to where you just can't watch it because it's just making too many movie mistakes?
Movie goofs don't actually bother me that much. You know, that to me is like, oh, that was a human moment. The guy forgot to, they're making a movie, they're doing their best. It got overlooked. What drove me crazy was when you would see the exact same things over and over and over again. Ebert wrote about that in his little movie glossary. You know, the fruit cart getting knocked over during the chase, or the scene where the person is leaving the room and then stops and turns and goes, hey, and the person's like, what? He goes, thanks. Like, just like over and over again. Those are the things that really kind of wore me down. Like, oh, I've seen this like 80 times now. Goofs always kind of delighted me. Those never really bothered me. I'm like, oh, that's kind of nice. These are people. They're doing their best.
I know I'm reading you like a fanboy here, but I can't help it. On this front, you know, you write about how you sort of got lost in the music or the movies here. You say, I didn't see a lot of things happening around me, like my boss's growing frustration with my constant whining about our show not being more innovative, or my girlfriend's disillusion, or a lot of my friends' avoidance of me, especially if there was the threat of movies entering the conversation. I had been an Asperger's-y movie fan when I got to L.A. 3 months earlier, and now, after scoping out where all the first-run rep museum and campus screenings were, I was a jabbering, repellent acolyte. So what was it in your patter on films that made you that repellent acolyte?
It's that, you know what that's like. You talk in paragraphs, basically. And it's all about – it's that classic thing that a lot of people do where they'll say, hey, do you know who was originally cast in this? And it's like, oh, you're not asking if I know. You want to tell me the information that you have. You have no interest in my input at all. So – and I would just do that a lot because it was a way to make me look smart and – I'm more wired in. I know more than you. And it's like, what does that matter? A conversation, a life has to have a back and forth to it.
Yeah, yes, yes, indeed. Danny,
and I just wasn't doing that.
No, it was all one way during the Silver Screen Fiend days. Dan in Nashville, you're on with Patton.
Oh, hey, guys. Great to talk to you. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk to Patton about sort of the idea of, you know, high and low art, whether it's in film or literature. And I had a double major in college in literature and film. And, mm-hmm. you know, with that, you're exposed to a lot of the classics and, you know, I guess like greatest creations of all time. But I wondered his thought on, you know, after seeing these things that are held in such high regard, you know, his love of things like comic books and, you know, TV and you know, zombies and whatnot, that I share too, what his thought is of appreciating the sort of what people consider like the pedestrian things as well as, you know, the lofty, fine film.
You can't watch 250 movies in a year without having both, I guess. How about it, Patton?
Well, and you gotta go on. It was the same thing I was learning in comedy. You can't just do the Largo. You got to do the Largo. Then you got to do the mainstream rooms. When you watch movies, you got to watch the high and the low. There's stuff to be found in trash. There just is. You know, there's just as much value in a movie, a Japanese movie like Inframan, or a slasher movie like Sleepaway Camp, as there is in, you know, last year at Marion Bad, or you know, the Letter. So, you know, you have to go. I think you have to draw from both. I mean, you can't appreciate eating at the French Laundry if you also don't understand how delicious an In-N-Out burger is.
Dan, I want to recommend to you, and I take your point there, Patton, recommend you. Patton talked with the New York Times Sunday Book Review, like, what was it, a week ago they published this?
Yeah.
About what he reads, Wallace Stevens and Right On Down. A really terrific interview. You're a double major in literature. Patton Oswalt is your guy. We'll put a link to it up at our website. But if you want to know what he reads on the side, it's a wonderful, wonderful assortment. Way more high than low, but this is a man of omnivorous taste here. Olivia in San Marcos, Texas. Olivia, you're on with Patton Oswalt.
Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, Patton. I'm excited to be on. Hi.
Oh, thanks. Thanks so much.
So, Patton, I have a question for you. Seeing that you're such a large cinephile, I'm really obsessed with animation, and I wanted to know your thoughts on, in my opinion, I think animation's kind of pushing the boundaries with genre, with different genres, kind of like earlier film, and having so many awesome characters that you would never been able to relate to in live action, for example, Ratatouille. And so I just wanted to know your thoughts on animation and kind of its part in cinematography.
Yeah, well, especially, you know, the year that Ratatouille got nominated for Best Animated Picture, the Pixar guys were very, very excited that another movie called Persepolis was nominated because it was super low budget. I think it was made on a MacBook. And it was them saying, this is great. This shows you that animation is just as much of a wild and woolly genre as, you know, regular film. There can be little indie films that suddenly explode, big budget stuff. So there, it's just another way to tell stories. And by the way, animation is just as limited in its way to reach an audience as live action is. They're both just as false. They're both just as much of a construct. It's just that with live action, you're dressing up people and shooting them at an angle that tells a story, and with animation, you've got to find a way to, especially when they would do the motion capture stuff and it would look too much like people. Mm-hmm. They learn very quickly, no, animation has to, you have to create a whole new style from the ground up that can still capture people, even though it doesn't necessarily look like real life.
With its own integrity somehow.
Exactly. And I think that really informs me, because with animation, you can do anything. But sometimes the limitation is, if you can do anything, it doesn't mean you should do everything. You should put limits on yourself and find ways to challenge it. So, you know, I think that I hope that was answering your question. I don't know if it did, but
Olivia, we'll take it. And Olivia, I appreciate your call. You've got tons of people who responded to the sort of siren call here about your obsession with movies that they love themselves. I mean, you know, The Body Snatcher and Dr. Zhivago and Princess Bride and Godfather and Eve's Bayou and Raise the Red Lantern and Attack of the Killer Tomatoes and Lawrence of Arabia. Our listeners on Facebook and beyond just pouring out the things they love. You quote Frank Capra saying, film is a disease. When it infects your bloodstream, it takes over. What was happening in that dream state that you were in? It wasn't all just kind of practical ambition, trying to learn the nuts and bolts. You were also off in that dream. What was going on in there in that night cafe?
I think what was going on was the trying to find the threads of this movie that was made in the 50s but takes place in the 1800s, this movie that was made in the early 70s that's about the actual early 70s, this movie that was made in the 80s but is about the year 3000. How do they all tie in with human experience and with stuff that people can relate to? So what is the, maybe not the common thread, but what are the ways in which, you know, I guess people can relate in on one second to Star Wars and then the next second to Five Easy Pieces? Mm-hmm. You know, they pull people in much the same way, and that's fascinating to me.
One more call. Blocker in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Blocker, you're on the air with Patton Oswalt.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Patton, a few years ago, a large group of miners were trapped underground in South America in a mine cave-in.
Right. Yep.
If you had been able to send them movies, not just to help them get through the experience, but to make them better men when they came back up onto the surface, what would you have sent them? I would start with Brother Sun, Sister Moon, maybe Defending Your Life, maybe Groundhog Day. How about you?
Yeah, Groundhog Day, Kurosawa's Ikiru, Only Angels Have Wings. There's a lot. My friend Jerry Duggan, he's a comic writer, tweeted, when we free the Chilean miners, we should all dress up in Planet of the Apes costumes.
While you were down.
No, some stuff changed, which I thought was just brilliant. So,
how about the very idea? Can films make us better people?
I think so, yeah. I mean, anything can make you a better person, just as long as you're open to it. I mean, you know, helping someone get on a bus before you can make you a better person. If you see that, oh, that little tiny pebble of movement I did could then, you know, lead to 18 other events going on. So yeah, you can watch a movie and come out of it and go, oh, I got to. I think that Akira Kurosawa's Ikiru is one of those. You watch it and then you rethink your life when it's done in a good way, not in a bad way, but it's pretty great. I think movies can definitely change your life.
There was real addiction, real obsession in your year. You had to kind of break it. It wasn't all welcome. But what was the good that you did come out of it with, Patton?
Well, the good I came out of it with was any kind of art should enhance your life. It shouldn't replace your life. That's the good I got out of it.
Yes. Lesson number one. Phantom Menace finally set you free. He said, enough already. I'm out of here. The spell was broken, and Patton Oswalt walked away from his years of movie obsession. He's written it up in the new book, Silver Screen Fiend. Patton, it was terrific talking with you today. Love the book on both the movie front and that coming into the creative life front. Thanks so much for sharing some time with us today.
Tom, thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Just terrific to spend the time with you. Patton Oswalt, thanks. Good luck with the book. Silver Screen Fiend is the book. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.